listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear new music and an interview with the Milwaukee band Field Report, who have a new album coming out tomorrow. First, some say crime in Milwaukee is a cycle. A violent crime happens, there's outrage, organizers create a solution, and money and resources pour into it. Then it's abandoned. And some of those solutions have been successful in other cities even after Milwaukee has given up on them. Ashley Lutheran dug into the problem for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers crime. Ashley, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, in your reporting, you see this pattern. Milwaukee comes up with a crime or violence prevention idea. They try it. Other places steal the idea. And then it fades out in Milwaukee. And this has happened, you write, multiple times, right?
It has. It's certainly a pattern that I've noticed in daily beat reporting here in Milwaukee over the past 5 years.
And let's start with one of the examples you share in your piece. The city's Homicide Review Commission started back in 2005, and people saw good results from it. Can you talk about the rise and fall of the Homicide Review Commission?
Sure, absolutely. So the Homicide Review Commission was set up to analyze deadly violence in the city, the idea being if you can understand what's causing deadly violence and non-fatal shootings, then you can have a better chance of addressing what those underlying issues are, seeing if there are gaps in any of the systems, like in the criminal justice system or other service providers. And this review really centers around strong collaboration. And I think what ended up happening as time went on, the commission developed recommendations for different system partners. But at the same time, the Milwaukee Police Department, arguably the most important partner in this collaboration, they were developing their own real-time data systems, crime analysis centers. And there seemed to be a little bit less, you know, some police officials, including former police chief Ed Flynn, felt that the commission wasn't really adding value. Other partners, like District Attorney John Chisholm, disagreed with that. As the police department started to pull back in about 2015, the commission found itself on life support. You know, they didn't have as much regular access to the police data. And because of that, they couldn't really do their work. The whole goal is to have this as a real-time analysis and response system for these issues in the city. Now, what's happened since then, the interim police chief here, Alfonso Morales, he has reinstated that kind of information sharing with the commission, and it does seem like it'll be coming back stronger, maybe taking some new forms. But as reporters, you could see this decline a little bit in terms of the delay when it came to getting the annual reports for the commission. The past few years, they've been coming out later and later, and really kind of the discussion around it faded away. So that was one example we wanted to look at. Now, as I said, it appears that it's being revived under the new administration here in Milwaukee, but we'll see what the future holds for them.
And then another initiative that kind of rose and fell was the community prosecution units. And again, this is one that's been replicated in other places. How did this work?
The community prosecution units are exceptionally popular in neighborhoods where they have been working for years. It pairs up a community prosecutor, a police officer, and a community organizer to work with residents to respond to community issues, quality of life issues, you know, shutting down drug houses, taking care of landlords who might be absentee and allowing nuisances to occur in their properties. And so this has been in Milwaukee since 2000. And at one point, at its height, there was one in every single police district. There are seven in the city of Milwaukee. And the problem is, in this case, is funding. Most of these prosecutor positions, and really they are built around the prosecutors, they are funded by federal grants. And as we know, with the change in presidential administrations, there are different priorities. Now, some will also argue, you know, a budget is where you show your priorities. So, you know, the district attorney's office, maybe the police department, they should be allocating money for this. You know, the district attorney's office will say, well, unfortunately, our funding for actual prosecutor positions is dictated by the state. You know, they've appealed to the state to try to get more prosecutors generally, more prosecutors for this specifically. But they haven't been successful. So they are hoping that they will be able to get more federal grants to try to bring this back. The other option is the private sector and the nonprofit sector. So here in Milwaukee, one collection of big-name groups that include Harley and MillerCoors and Marquette University, they have put some money together, and they do have the Near West Side partners, and they have funded a community prosecution unit through their private dollars. So that may be a model going forward, but funding really is an issue with those.
Talking to Ashley Lutheran from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel about crime and violence prevention efforts in Milwaukee and why they seem to rise and fall, even when other cities are stealing these ideas and finding success with many of them. Ashley, those are just a couple of the examples you reported on. I want to get into a couple of common themes. One of them you just mentioned with the community prosecution unit, inconsistent or unstable funding. Has this been a recurring theme in different crime prevention efforts?
Yes, it absolutely has been. And that's something when you talk to people at the city, county, other governmental levels, they all point to funding as a you know, systemic problem. And if you talk to outside experts, someone like Patrick Sharkey, who's has a new book out, Uneasy Peace, which sort of documents the unsung role of nonprofits and community groups in helping to lower violence, you know, he says we haven't really made what he calls a sustained, durable commitment to these kinds of things, you know, guaranteeing funding for them. We see, and there are a variety of reasons for that, but one of the most common is when we talk about addressing crime, we almost always turn immediately to what can the criminal justice system do. And we sort of historically have undervalued the role that community groups and people working on the blocks are doing every day with very few resources to keep their neighborhoods safer.
Another theme you write about is the idea that for any of these things to work, they tend to have to be collaborations between police organizations, city, county government, community groups that you were just talking about, city council, others. And in many of these cases, people didn't play well together. Is that right?
Yes. It's no secret that we have our share of strong personalities. You know, there's been clashes between, you know, our former police chief Ed Flynn and, you know, former Sheriff David A. Clark Jr. We've had clashes between local governments here and the state. And then there's also just sort of, you know, different people who are running different agencies and organizations can have different priorities at different times. So it can be a matter as well of, okay, well, I think now our focus should be on this issue and not this one. There's also sort of this theme of once you have some early success, there tends to be an impulse to look elsewhere, right? So we've solved this problem, we move away from it and look at a different one. And then the successes that you saw earlier kind of fade away and the problem reemerges. So you have a clash of personalities sometimes, different priorities, and it can be hard to get everyone on the same page. And then sometimes it certainly does not help when there are very public spats that are occurring between different leaders of organizations.
And the irony here is that as these programs fall by the wayside in Milwaukee, people in law enforcement and other groups around the country are saying, hey, we borrowed this idea from you in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
It's going like gangbusters here.
Yes. You've seen that with other places that have used community prosecution units to greatest success. What's interesting, you know, here in Milwaukee, I'll be writing about this in the future in more depth, but the Homicide Review Commission actually went out to the city of Oakland, California, and train their police department on how to do reviews of non-fatal shootings in real time. And then Oakland took that strategy, tweaked it, added a stronger community component, and now you're hearing Interim Police Chief Alfonso Morales talking about how he wants that to be a core component of his strategy for the department here in Milwaukee. So, again, kind of taking an idea that originated here in Milwaukee, another city used, and, you know, strengthen it for what they wanted to achieve, and now Milwaukee's saying, all right, let's bring it back, or let's use this strategy.
There are changes in leadership in key law enforcement positions in Milwaukee, a sheriff and police chief in the city of mm-hmm. Milwaukee. Is there a sense that, hey, maybe this is a time where people can do things differently, come up with more sustainable long-term efforts?
I think that certainly is the feeling on the ground here in Milwaukee, that there's a lot of opportunity. It's sort of a natural time to take a beat and look and examine what has worked and what, you know, the city as a whole and the county as a whole wants to do moving forward. And this is all happening in a larger backdrop, you know, as the state is preparing to remake how it handles juvenile justice.
Ashley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Ashley Lutheran. She's a public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. We were talking about long-term efforts to prevent crime and violence in Milwaukee. The Milwaukee band Field Report is releasing their third album tomorrow called Summertime Songs. They recently stopped back by Buck Studio and gave us a preview of their newest material. And we talked to band frontman Chris Porterfield about the collaborative process behind the album. Chris, welcome back to Buck Studio.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
Well, you've had some changes. Congratulations, first of all. I understand you're a new dad. How are you settling into musicianship fatherhood?
That's a true story. I've kind of been off the road for a little bit. We've been figuring out all of this record stuff. And in the meantime, as we were making this record, my daughter came. And so I've been stay-at-home dad now for, she's a year and a half old. And now we're just starting to test the waters on how those two things are going to coexist. Because before her, it was just all music. And since her, it's been all her. And now we're muddying the waters a bit here. We'll see how it plays out.
You're going to be arranging your life on tour now.
Yeah, right.
Kids change your view on the world. Your life is different. Did that shake up your music or your lyrics or how you thought about the music at all?
Kids are not unlike other human beings in that if you allow them into your life, you're going to find yourself changing. But yeah, there's a tune on this record that's kind of... Not all the narrators on this record are me, but some of them are, and one of them is about being real nervous about being a parent. See, I've been running hot, babe, something's gonna give. I've been sleeping out, babe, dreaming about the kid. But yeah, man, it shakes you up. It shakes things out to the bottom, and then you figure out what really matters and what doesn't. And in the neighbor's window across the street, you can see the TV through the fitted red sheet. And the other night, I heard him screaming. Now I turned off our lights, called the police, and hit it on the corner of the front porch, waiting, and as quiet as a gas leak, I slowed my breathing.
It's interesting, the narrator voice in your songs. You mentioned some of them are you, some of them are something else. They all feel raw and autobiographical, whether you're the autobiography or this character is. What's the split on this new album?
I mean, it can go line to line. The whole thing with songs is that as long as you create something that could be believable, it is. It's true. And so I don't know if it's a 50-50 split. It's probably less than that, honestly. There's a bunch of narrators, from my point of view, that are not me. But some of them are. The week the dog went deaf, I called for her all night. When I found her, I stared into her big dumb eyes and mouthed everything's all right.
The song means something, maybe in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And when I listen, it might mean something different. When that person over there listens, it's something different again. I mean, is that part of the fun of creating a song?
I think it's something that's magical about songs that I've learned over the years, that they really can be useful. And these things that you build and construct so carefully, from words to melodies to sounds to arrangements, all of these things, all this lattice work turns into this structure almost, that somebody else can climb inside and inhabit and look around and find their own meaning and value and comfort and shelter and safety and danger. I woke up blacked out in a snowstorm with an airbag burn on my cheek. Check the red.
Another thing that's changed is the band, Field Report. It's a different lineup now. How much does that change the music? Is it that you've collaborated with these guys and that makes a new sound, or you had a new sound in mind and you sought these guys out to fit into what you're looking for? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, this band is They're amazing. It's Thomas Winsek on keys, Barry Clark on bass, and Devin Drobka on drums. And I've never played with a group of people like them before. And so from the beginning of recording this record, this was not, hey guys, come on over. I have a bunch of completed songs I'd like you to dress up. It was, okay, I'm going to throw some stuff down in the studio. You come over and react to it, and I'll react to that. It was like a collaborative painting studio or something, where we would just show up where we knew we could get consistently good light and have the time and tools to work and just start layering things and sculpting things. And, you know, and so that it was a very collaborative process in that way, responding to one another's energy and ideas.
Being sensitive to energy, you said. So that means maybe something unexpected that wasn't part of your original vision for a particular song happened and... What, you follow that path?
Absolutely, 100%. If something is getting me excited, then chances are somebody who has any kind of familiarity or relationship with my work is going to feel that too. Because that magic spot is when we are somehow opening some kind of portal into whatever it is that's beyond us.
That sounds fun.
Dude, when it works, it's a blast.
Okay, are there times when it doesn't work where you feel like you're all banging your head against the wall?
Yeah, and that's when the craftsmanship comes in. You just go to work and start building stuff. Maybe it'll be useful, maybe it won't be good, but you just keep showing up. Baby, I don't trust this mold.
You use a lot of metaphors from visual art and crafts. Do you do anything like that? Are you a music guy only, or are you a tinkerer in other ways?
No, I'm no good.
No?
No. Yeah, no. I think I took a cartooning class in fourth grade. There was a period where
It didn't stick.
It didn't stick, no. I kind of peaked with tracing Simpsons heads.
Last time you were up here, we talked about your sobriety. Your previous album dealt a lot with that. Are you working through things in this new album, or is this a different space in your life now?
Yeah, I mean, you never totally fully close that door, but I've got a lot better handle on things now. And one thing that I've noticed in starting to think about what this record is as we talk about it more with other people... I think there was a lot of space that alcohol and my relationship with it had occupied that was sucking up opportunities for empathy. It was just taking up too much space, and it was making a lot of my work more inward-focused. And now that that is kind of starting to scab over and not be so fresh, I'm finding a lot more people, other voices in some of the work that we're doing. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think when you're lousy and hungover and regretting whatever had happened the night before, you tend to write songs about that. And this is a little bit, there are moments of that on this record, but it's from a little bit more time has passed. Every time I hear the phone, every time my cover's blown, every time I think of home, and every time it's not dissimilar from the studio process, where if you feel something, if something is exciting, then pay attention to that. And if we're having a conversation, you and I, and something is like, oh, whoa, that's something. There's just a lot of energy flowing back and forth, man. It's a far-out cosmic thing, sort of.
I was going to say, I don't want to take this into, like, X-Men territory here, but this is sounds like a really, like, I don't know, metaphysical process for you.
Yeah. As somebody who has zero understanding of how that works, uh-huh. I mean, It's like a sort of a unified theory of something. Uh-huh. I don't know what it is. Somebody else can figure it out, but I know what I feel.
Are there songs, ideas for songs floating in your head that are like, these are good, these aren't what I want to do with Field Report? Do you have other, either desire for other outlets or other outlets for those songs?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that I've been thinking about over the course of making this record and everything, figuring out what Field Report is. And we're a pop band, and I feel really good about that. But yeah, we do have other outlets. I mean, everybody in this band has a bunch of projects. Devin and Barry and I have an improvised trio, all improvised music, instrumental music. Tom and Barry play together recently as All Tiny Creatures, like an electro sort of driven pop project. Devin's about to take off to Europe to play drums material that he hasn't even learned yet, like jazz stuff with some, I think he's a Polish bass player and a great Chicago saxophone player. So we've all got stuff all over the place, and it's beautiful because all that stuff sort of seeps in to this sort of permeable membrane that is this loosely defined Field Report thing. And so we get all of these things into the folk songs and the pop songs, and it's just really, really fun.
Well, Chris and Loosely Defined Field Report thing, thanks a lot for coming up.
It's good to be here.
That's Chris Porterfield of the Milwaukee band Field Report. They recently stopped by Buck Studio to play and to talk about their new album, Summertime Songs, which comes out tomorrow. First, a judge ruled today that Governor Walker needs to call special elections to fill two vacant seats in the state legislature. Dane County Circuit Court Judge Josanne Reynolds ruled that the voting rights of people living in those districts were being infringed. Sean Johnson is here to give us the latest. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Wisconsin Public Radio News Department. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
We've been hearing you in the news throughout the afternoon talking about this. Tell us more about what went into the judge's ruling. What was the case she ended up making here?
Well, Judge Josanne Reynolds walked through the kind of the decisions that she had to make as a judge as to when, you know, when she would step in a case like this, when she would step in and order a governor to order special elections. And kind of all along the way, she said that, you know, there was just a clear a clear law that spelled this out is what it boiled down to, is that the law for when to order special elections in Wisconsin is pretty clear that if a vacancy occurs before the second Tuesday in May, you order them. Governor Walker had said that because these vacancies in particular occurred in late December, that it didn't apply. But Judge Reynolds said that led to an absurd result because somebody could leave the legislature right now and the governor would have to call a special election, whereas these vacancies occurred last December, and he's saying he's not required to.
What are the options now for the governor?
Well, you can appeal. You can ask for a stay. We don't know what the governor's going to do. When I've reached out to his office, they said they were just reviewing their options with the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Wisconsin Department of Justice said they were talking it over with their client being the governor. So we don't know what their next steps are going to be, but this is a state court case involving a state law in the Wisconsin state constitution. So if it gets appealed, it would be through, the state appeals court, and the final, arbiter in these cases would be the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, where conservatives have a majority. But as of right now, it was decided in county court, and the judge there gave a very clear decision that she viewed this as a clear violation of state law by Governor Walker.
The governor has said even if there were a special election, that by the time the lawmakers got into office, they wouldn't have much to do. That's probably more true now since it's a couple months down the road. If this process started, would the new legislator do a lot of legislating?
So that was something that Judge Reynolds mentioned as she gave her decision from the bench, is that, you know, that this governor, Governor Walker, has a history of calling special sessions, and that as she was sitting down to draft the outline of her decision last week, he called another one. The legislature is meeting in today. The governor called last week a special session on school safety. And Judge Reynolds said there was a very real possibility, given his history of doing that, that he might call another one later this year. And she specifically referenced Wisconsin's redistricting case, which is currently before the U.S. Supreme Court, and said it was very possible that if the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in that case, Wisconsin's legislature could get called back to Madison for a special session this year to deal with whatever the U.S. Supreme Court decides in that case.
Sean, thanks for the update, and I think we'll be talking to you about this again soon.
All right, you're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Now, the conventional wisdom is that this year's midterm elections could be trouble for Republicans around the country and here in Wisconsin. Traditionally, the party that holds the White House is at a disadvantage in midterm races like 2018. And in recent months, Democrats have won seats in districts that went handily for Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. That includes a congressional race in Pennsylvania, a U.S. Senate contest in Alabama, and a state Senate race here in Wisconsin, in the western part of the state. Donald Trump won the 10th state Senate district by 17 points, and the seat had been represented by Republican Sheila Harsdorf. Republicans held that seat for 17 years until Governor Walker appointed Harsdorf to be agriculture secretary. Here's what Governor Walker had to say after Democrat Patty Schachner won by 11 points in a special election back in January.
I really think looking ahead, it's a wake-up call that just because really good things are happening, that unlike Washington, where a lot of people are frustrated with Washington. I think even some of the people in that 10th Senate district were frustrated with Washington not getting the job done. In Wisconsin, we're getting really good and positive things done for the people of our state.
This fall, Wisconsinites will vote for a governor, attorney general, state lawmakers, Congress, and a U.S. Senate seat. Our next guest says state Republican insiders are not feeling all that great about their party's chances of hanging on to power, but they think Republicans have a shot. Jerry Bader is the communications director at Media Trackers and a former talk radio host in northeastern Wisconsin. He blogs at jerrybaderlive.com. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, you talked to a couple of Wisconsin Republican insiders. What kind of things were they talking about here in March?
So let's start. I have Insider 1 and Insider 2. These are two people, I will tell you, their jobs are to win elections for Republicans. Insider 1 is actually far more pessimistic than Insider 2, and he quite frankly puts this at the feet of Donald Trump, and he really doesn't know how. Let's start at the state level. Legislative races and the governor, you can't run against Donald Trump, but he is on the ballot with everyone with an R behind their name. And what both guys do agree on, that I spoke with both sources, is on the state level, all you can do is run on those legislative accomplishments, things that got done as the soundbite with Governor Walker just a bit ago. But one of the sources I spoke with is, it just being pretty blunt here, he thinks a best-case scenario is just a regular, horrible midterm election. He leans toward a bloodbath. He just doesn't see Republicans at any level outrunning the shadow of Donald Trump.
Now, Republicans, and Governor Walker has alluded to this, they have the opportunity to point toward very low, record low, as we're hearing in the news today, unemployment numbers. They can point toward Foxconn boosting the state's economy. They'll run on their record of tax cuts. I mean, on paper, from a Republican election perspective, they have some banners to wave here, right?
They do. And there's no doubt about it. As a conservative, I certainly believe that the resume looks pretty good. A lot of items ticked off the conservative agenda here in Wisconsin. But the problem is there are a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump who did a leap of faith. And they've got buyer's remorse. And what's going to happen is, I don't care if it's a state Senate race, I don't care if it's Governor Walker, All any Democrat has to do, well, what about Stormy Daniels? What about congratulating Vladimir Putin? And I could go on and on and on. And that's just, it's just an anvil that weighs down that track record that they're trying to run on, in the opinion of the two people I spoke with and in my opinion.
Now, people point toward the special elections, the one in Wisconsin for the state Senate, the Connor Lamb win in Pennsylvania and other places. And you could say, okay, that's a special election, got a lot of attention. Maybe those are outliers. Are people in Wisconsin talking about Virginia with this dramatic switch in one of the chambers of the legislature, keeping the governor's position there for Democrats? Is that a warning sign that Wisconsin Republicans are talking about?
Yeah, you know, outliers are when you have one. When you have one and another and another and another, it's hard to say it's an outlier. Virginia and Pennsylvania, I think the metaphor is apropos. That is one dead canary in the coal mine. I mean, that is, if Republicans don't look at that and see the headwind they're facing, they're delusional.
Can Wisconsin state Republicans, not whatever the opposite of nationalize is this election, can they say, hey, forget those guys in Washington. This is our, these seats, the Assembly, the Senate, Governor, this is about Wisconsin.
I think they can. And let me say this. I think Governor Walker can. Let's take them separately. Governor Walker and the state Senate, which, of course, is the most vulnerable to fault the Democrats. Governor Walker can. It's going to depend so much on who he faces. We have no idea. There are so many people in that primary. A weak candidate could, with the pie sliced that many ways, come out, and then he has a very good chance. If one of what I consider the credible candidates get the nomination, I think it will be the fight of his life, the worst he's ever faced. I think control of the state Senate is in real danger for Republicans.
How about the attorney general race? Is that one you have your eye on?
I do, but I really have not done much tea leaf reading at this early juncture. The Oppo research is flying on the Democratic candidate already. In any other year, I would say Brad Schimmel is probably safe. I honestly believe no one with an R behind their name is safe in 2018.
Read from Mark on Facebook, who writes, the state Democratic Party is so inept, I would expect larger margins in state legislature, in the state legislature and congressional delegation. Can the Republicans pin some hope on the Wisconsin State Democratic Party not being on their game?
That's a great point. And I'm going to say no, that it's not a fact. Now, they are inept, they are incompetent, and we have seen that. One of the sources I spoke with put it this way. I won't say the word. He said, bleeped off people are more energized than happy people, or that are people that are seeing things get done. Democrats are really angry, and the enthusiasm gap is off the charts. And I would argue that enthusiasm gap blows away the Democratic ineptitude.
Talking to Jerry Bader about state Republicans' concerns, hopes, and especially fears about the 2018 midterm elections. Jerry's a communications director at Media Trackers now, former talk radio host in northeastern Wisconsin. He blogs at jerrybaderlive.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think 2018 will be a wave year for Democrats in Wisconsin, a bloodbath, as we've heard some Republicans are worried? Should Governor Walker be worried about his chances of winning a third term? Or do you think there's a strong case for Republican candidates? Do you have ideas on how they should run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about whether state Republicans are headed for trouble in this year's midterm elections. Jerry Bader is with us, communications director at Media Trackers, former talk radio host in northeastern Wisconsin. You can follow his blog at jerrybaderlive.com. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democrats are going to win big here in Wisconsin, in the state legislature, congressional seats, Senate, governor? Should Governor Walker be worried about his chances of repeating, or are you feeling, if you're Republican, pretty good about your party? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hi. I traditionally voted Republican for a lot of different reasons, but my biggest reason I voted Republican is for Democratic policies to remain and the Constitution to be upheld. And what I found now is that these people that always kind of had a conservative standpoint on things, they're not in contact with the conservative constituents that they once had. And they're losing out to people like me. I'm a young dairy farmer who's trying to compete against mega dairies that don't have to follow the same rules that a smaller farm would as far as hiring illegal immigrants, things like that. And these type of large special interest type of economic forces are really guiding these people. So I wrote letters to our representatives in the Assembly, State Assembly. I wrote letters to Senator Ron Johnson. I wrote letters to Paul Ryan's office. I sent letters to Governor Walker's office. The only people that I got letters back from or any response from about agricultural issues that I'm really concerned about and upholding democracy and helping young farmers continue to be able to compete with mega dairies who are using a lot of loopholes and government funding to try to fund their mega dairies, and they complain that they're not making money. Well, they should see what somebody like me is trying to do. Anyway, so the only people that returned my letters were interim Secretary of Agriculture Jeff Lyons.
I'm going to jump in, Owen, because I want to bring Jerry in and have time for other callers. But Owen's saying, hey, I'm Republican. I voted conservative. I feel like, Owen says, the Republicans are out of touch with my needs.
Well, I think to a degree, I understand where Owen is coming from. Here's what I would say in response to that, though. All the oxygen is being sucked up by the daily drama from the West Wing. And I think it's unprecedented in history how that is seeping down to the lower levels of government. And if Republicans at any level do get anything accomplished in the House on the federal level, for example, all sorts of things passed, didn't make it through the Senate. But nobody is paying attention to the sausage factory anymore. Everybody is paying attention to the circus, the sideshow.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jess in Spring Green. Jess, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had a question. With you had mentioned the Republicans, you know, possibly having a bloodbath, and the Democrats maybe an F. And I was wondering what your take would be on possibly a third party, maybe an independent party coming to fruition.
Jerry, what do you think?
I heard a joke on the House of Cards goes like this. The third party is the future and always will be, meaning that it's just never going to be realized. And here's what I would say. I think it's more possible than ever. That's still not saying much. It's more possible than ever because of the anger level. You saw a split in both parties in 2016. It could happen. But the forces, the power that each major party has right now makes it very, very difficult.
Thanks for the call, Jess. I wanted to talk about a couple other races that we haven't spent much time on. The contest for Congress, we have mostly what are considered safe seats here for the House, and the U.S. Senate race. Where do you see those going, Jerry?
Well, let's start with the big one, the Senate race. I will tell you, I believe in this year, Tammy Baldwin is going to be very, very difficult to defeat for a couple of reasons. I really don't like the way the primary is shaping up. I just don't. It's turning into a mud throw that we saw in 2012. That doesn't help. But quite frankly, the landscape that you have, people who voted, and I'll say it again, buyer's remorse for Donald Trump in Wisconsin in 2016, now have an opportunity to vote against him. Here's what I would say. You said safe seats. Keep a close eye on Glenn Grothman in the 6th Congressional District. He is absolutely just terrified for his life. He's facing Herb Kohl's nephew. A lot of family money there. And Glenn is making no bones about it. He's terrified. I think that seat's going to get targeted. If there is a House seat in Wisconsin to watch, that would be the one.
That would really be something.
No, it would. I mean, it's a very red district,
yeah.
and that's where people might be going, huh? But I'm telling you, all bets are off in 2018.
Jerry Bader is with us looking at Republican prospects in the 2018 midterm elections. Back to your calls now. James is on the line in Mauston. James, hi.
Hi. I'm an independent from central Wisconsin, and I was curious how the Republican Party is going to solve, this is a very large kind of concept, but institutional corruption throughout Wisconsin and then at the national level.
And what are you talking about more specifically when you say institutional corruption, James?
Yeah, that's pretty broad. Specifically how money through the elections affects policy at the state level and then also eventually at the national level.
James, gotcha. So money in politics, campaign finance, Jerry, is that an issue that Republicans need to have a message on, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I would, my inclination would be to say no, it is. It has been very high on the agenda in the past. Democrats do use that as a cudgel, but the reality is that there's big money on both sides. And I just, you know, would I like to see a different way? Yeah, but I don't. I just, it's so far down the national agenda, the psyche, that it has been years past. I just don't see much discussion about it this fall.
James, thanks. Let's go next to Jenny on the line in Milwaukee. Jenny, hi.
Hi. My comment is just, I think there would be more opportunity for a Democratic bloodbath, quote unquote, if they would put forth more of an aspirational agenda. I mean, I think there's a real opportunity here for the Dems to be leading with a very progressive agenda. And I'm still unclear about where everybody's standing, except, you know, that they don't like Scott Walker.
Jenny, thanks for the call. And people have accused Democrats of that in the past, just running against Donald Trump or running against Scott Walker in past elections. What do you think, Jerry?
I think this is the best year ever to be running against something, to be perfectly candid with you. I think it's a valid point by the caller. I do. They're not advancing an agenda because they really don't feel that they need one. They have tried, they've wanted to say that Scott Walker has broken the Wisconsin economy. It looks like they may actually give up on that with the record low unemployment numbers that came out, because they're asking people to believe what they're saying or their own lying eyes. Wisconsin's economy is doing quite well. They are going to bank on that, quite frankly, in my opinion, that they don't need an agenda. They have anger. And when you have anger and when you have enthusiasm, sometimes look at 2016 and Donald Trump. That's all you need.
Some people have pointed toward, again, going back to Virginia, a lot of the more liberal Democratic candidates there, one, not running against Donald Trump, but running on, you know, potholes and better transportation and things like that. Can Democrats come with the bread and butter, not necessarily economy issues, but infrastructure, things like that?
Well, I think, yeah, I think the answer is yes. More so on the state level, and you know, that's certainly the Achilles heel. That's one of the areas where they're going to attack Governor Walker, is certainly road infrastructure. So maybe not. That's not the best example, but I do think there are, you know, spending more on education than ever before, taxes, on and on and on. They can do that at the state level. They still have the specter of Donald Trump. The federal offices, that's going to be really tough.
Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jerry Bader, Communications Director at Media Trackers, former talk radio host in northeastern Wisconsin. You can follow his blog at jerrybaderlive.com. And you can still share your thoughts on prospects for the 2018 elections. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a nationwide study finds that most states don't have enough money set aside for tough times. A longtime political observer tells us why Wisconsin is on that list. We'll check out the top stories in Wisconsin news, including the designation of economic opportunity zones in communities around the state. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, a timely topic, we'll get advice on how to cook with maple syrup. It's not just for pancakes and waffles anymore. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.